Hello to everyone who is listening to this talk online. I'm re-recording it because at the Zendo Sunday I forgot to press the record button. It's something I used to do frequently when we first started recording talks, but haven't done that for a while. So I want to feel as though I'm actually speaking to people. So I will greet you and say that if you've been following these practice period talks, you know that we've been doing a kind of Lotus Sutra immersion course. And you'll know that the Lotus Sutra begins with a huge assembly of arhats, the Buddha's original disciples, bodhisattvas, and various heavenly and supernatural beings assembled on Vulture Peak, which is an actual location in India, which apparently is nowhere near large enough to accommodate such a massive assembly. So we know that we are in myth time. This assembly has come because the Buddha is about to preach the Lotus Sutra, which he never quite does, as we're starting to realize. He uses many similes and parables to explain that he has used various skillful means to encourage all beings to practice the Dharma and be free from suffering. And Michael talked about the parable of the burning house last week, and over the coming weeks we'll hear from Susan, Claire, and Flo about three more parables the Buddha used to illustrate skillful means. But the Lotus Sutra talks about itself a lot in a curiously self-referenced way without the Buddha ever actually preaching the Lotus Sutra, although he gives many many hints along the way. The basic message of the Lotus Sutra is that the ultimate truth of the Dharma is inexpressible, which is in a way enacted by this story of the Lotus Sutra. And that all teachings, including the Lotus Sutra itself, are skillful means. They're provisional expressions to motivate us to practice. The further message is that every one of us, indeed all beings, are of Buddha nature and can follow the Bodhisattva path and realize Buddhahood. Notice that I'm not saying all beings have Buddha nature. I'm saying all Buddhas are of Buddha nature. To paraphrase Dogen Zenji, Buddha nature is not a thing we can have or not have. It is what we are. I also hesitate to use the phrase become a Buddha, though you will find it used repeatedly in this text. I prefer to say realize Buddhahood or actualize Buddhahood. And again, I'm influenced by Dogen, who taught that practice and realization are not separate, not practice here and realization way out there, far away in the distant future. Dogen taught that we actualize both practice and realization when we awake to each moment, right here and now. At any rate, for several chapters of the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha predicts that the various kinds of followers present in the assembly will become Buddhas, starting with his original disciples, then the myriad bodhisattvas and other beings, even criminals and women. Who seem to have been added to the original text at a later date, which I'll discuss more in another talk in a couple of weeks. After predicting the Buddhahood of all the beings in the assembly, and by the way, Michael mentioned in his talk Wednesday that in order for a being to become a Buddha, the Buddhahood has to have been predicted by another Buddha. Thus, all these predictions. So after all the predictions, the Buddha tells the assembly, and by extension all of us, that they must uphold and preach the Lotus Sutra. How do we do this? The Buddha tells us in one of the most beautiful passages in the sutra, and I'll read Jean Rhee's translation. If people are to teach this sutra, let them enter the Tathagata's room. The Tathagata is the Buddha. Let them enter the Buddha's room, put on the Buddha's robe, and sit on the Buddha's seat. Face the multitude without fear. Let them teach it clearly everywhere. With great compassion as their room, gentleness and patience as their robe, and the emptiness of all things as their seat. Doing this, they should teach the Dharma. So the very seat we sit upon is groundless, boundless, and we are sheltered in the Buddha's kindness, compassion, and patience, so we can fearlessly offer the Dharma to others, which is to say, we can offer our lives and practice, just as they are, in each moment. To me, this is more revelatory than all the earthquakes, jewels, and flowers showering from the heavens, with which the Lotus Sutra abounds. The next two chapters of the Lotus Sutra present two of the most stunning images in the whole sutra, which lead up to its dramatic climax. First, an elaborate towering bejeweled stupa arises from the earth and floats in the air. From it comes a booming voice praising the Buddha for preaching the Lotus Sutra for the benefit of the assembly. Those present are, of course, in great awe and bow down to the stupa. One of the bodhisattvas asks the Buddha why the stupa has arisen from the earth and whose voice that was. The Buddha explains that it is a former Buddha from another world an immeasurable distance away, called Many Treasures, who had made a great vow to appear when the Lotus Sutra was preached, whenever the Lotus Sutra was preached, and to say words of praise. The Bodhisattva then makes a request that the assembly will be permitted to see Many Treasures Buddha in the stupa. The Buddha explains that part of the vow Many Treasures made is that he will only reveal himself if the Buddha who has preached the Lotus Sutra calls in all the Buddhas that are emanations from his body throughout countless worlds. So Buddhas have the ability to create transformation bodies of themselves and send them throughout worlds to preach the Dharma. So at this request, Shakyamuni Buddha emits a ray of light from the tuft of white hair between his eyebrows, which illuminates countless distant worlds. What follows is an elaborate description of innumerable Buddhas, each with a bodhisattva attendant assembling worlds in the 10 directions, and each taking a lion's seat beneath a huge bejeweled tree. Then all of the attendants come and greet the Buddha and pay homage. I'll read you what happens next from the text. Shakyamuni Buddha, with the fingers of his right hand, then opened the door of the Tower of 7 Treasures. A loud sound issued from it, like the sound of a lock and crossbar being removed from a great city gate. And at once all the members of the assembly caught sight of Many Treasures Buddha, seated on a lion seat inside the treasure tower, his body whole and unimpaired, sitting as though engaged in meditation. And they heard him say, "Excellent, excellent, Shakyamuni Buddha, you have preached this Lotus Sutra in a spirited manner. I have come here in order that I may hear this sutra." Next, Many Treasures Buddha invites Shakyamuni Buddha to share his seat in the stupa, which he does by rising up through the air. The assembly then requests to be allowed to see them both, so the Buddha uses his superpowers to raise them all up in the air. From his seat in the stupa, he then addresses them and asks, "Who is capable of broadly preaching the Lotus Sutra in this Saha world?" The Saha world is our world, this world of suffering. "Now is the time to do so, for before long, the thus come one will enter nirvana. The thus come one is himself. He's referring to himself in the third person. The Buddha wishes to entrust this Lotus Sutra to someone so that it will be preserved. And that's where the chapter ends. It's a real cliffhanger. The story picks up again after three chapters that seem to have been inserted later, and we can safely skip over them for the moment. What happens next is that the bodhisattvas who have assembled, all these bodhisattvas who have come from the 10 directions, respond to the Buddha's question, offering to preserve the Lotus Sutra after he's gone. But to everyone's great surprise, the Buddha declines their offer. He says, "Leave off, good men. There is no need for you to protect this sutra. Why? Because in this Saha world of mine, there are bodhisattvas and mahasattvas who are as numerous as the sands of 60,000 Ganges. And each of these bodhisattvas has a retinue equal to the sands of 60,000 Ganges. After I have entered extinction, these persons will be able to protect, read, recite, and widely preach this sutra." In other words, he's saying to this vast cosmic assembly, "Thanks, guys, but I have plenty of bodhisattvas to help right here in this world." Again, from the text. When the Buddha spoke these words, the earth of the thousand millionfold countries of the Saha world all trembled and split open, and out of it emerged at the same instant immeasurable thousands, ten thousands, millions of bodhisattvas and mahasattvas. The bodies of these bodhisattvas were all golden in hue, with 32 features and an immeasurable brightness. Previously, they had all been dwelling in the world of empty space underneath the Saha world. But when these bodhisattvas heard the voice of Shakyamuni Buddha speaking, they came up from below. So when all these myriad bodhisattvas have emerged from the earth, they each pay homage to the two Buddhas seated in the jeweled stupa, and then to all the Buddhas seated on lion seats beneath the jeweled trees. Remember, there are countless Buddhas seated in the air beneath the jeweled trees. During all this, the Buddha and all the assembly sit in silence, in zazen, for 50 small kalpas. Do you remember what a kalpa is? It's an extremely long period of time. But they all feel as if it's only taken half a day. Now, as you might imagine, the bodhisattvas from the other worlds and the 10 directions are a little disconcerted by this turn of events. After all, they had assumed that they would be the ones to continue the Buddha's teaching after his death. So they elect four of their great leaders to approach the Buddha and ask. "Is the world honored one comfortable, with few illnesses, few worries? In teaching and converting living beings, can you do so without fatigue and weariness? And do living beings receive instruction readily or not? Does it not cause the world-honored one to become weary and spent?" You see, they're angling. They're saying, "Don't you need us? Don't you need us to help?" But the Buddha replies, to put it briefly, "Yes, it's going quite well, thank you." And the four bodhisattva representatives reply politely, "Excellent, excellent. We are overjoyed." At this point, the bodhisattva Maitreya, who himself has been waiting around for many kalpas to become the future Buddha, must be thinking to himself, "This conversation is getting nowhere," because he intervenes and comes to the point. Well, actually, he goes on at some length, but basically, he comes to the point. "What's the deal with this multitude of bodhisattvas emerging from the earth? Who are they?" The Buddha explains that since his enlightenment, he has been teaching these bodhisattvas who have been practicing diligently within the earth. This still seems a little far-fetched to Maitreya and the countless other bodhisattvas. So Maitreya asked the Buddha to explain how he could have taught such an incomprehensible number of bodhisattvas in the short time of his temporal life on earth. He says, "It is as though a young man, just turned 25, were to point to a 100-year-old man with gray hair and wrinkled face and say, 'I sired him,' and the old man were to say, 'This is my father.' The father youthful, the son old. No one in the world could believe this." And that's the end of that chapter. It's another cliffhanger. This could really be a Netflix serial. In the next chapter, the Buddha makes the climactic revelation of the whole Lotus Sutra, that his very birth and death in this world are skillful means to bring suffering beings to the Dharma, that in reality, he's an eternal presence who manifests again and again and again throughout various world systems. This chapter is often referred to as the lifespan chapter, and it's chanted regularly in Soto Zen monasteries in Japan. But it's never really caught on here in the West, probably because of the fantastical aspects of the story. But Michael will talk more about the lifespan chapter on Wednesday. I want now to talk about the significance of the earth bodhisattvas. This image of the myriad bodhisattvas emerging from the earth evokes two associations. One is the legend of the night of the Buddha's awakening, when he's assailed by the armies of Mara, the demon who tempts him with desire, fear, and doubt. Mara mocks him, saying, "Look at my vast armies. Who can bear witness to my great power? Who is here to bear witness for you? No one." The Buddha reaches down, and in a beautiful gesture, he touches the earth, saying, "The earth is my witness." At that, the earth quakes and cracks open, and an earth goddess rises up, who wrings out her wet hair and causes a flood of water, washing away Mara's legions. I find the image of the Buddha's earth-touching gesture deeply moving. So often over the years, when I've been assailed by my own demons of fear, doubt, or longing, I've reached for the earth to steady and still my heart and mind, to help me remember my true being. The other image that comes to mind is that of Jizo Bodhisattva, Kshitigarbha in Sanskrit, Titsang in Chinese, whose name means earth womb, or by extension, earth storehouse. This name suggests the earth as a womb or nurturing place for bodhisattvas or awakening beings, which is to say, all of us. We are of the earth. Earth, water, fire, and air. Jizo is beloved in Japan as the protector of women, travelers, and particularly of young children. He does not appear in the Lotus Sutra, but he came to prominence in the Mahayana Buddhism that entered China, where a sutra was written about him called the Sutra of the Past Vows of Earth Womb Bodhisattva. I'd like to read you a passage. I'm going to pause the recording for a minute. So, reading from the sutra of the past vows of earth womb bodhisattva. At the time of his death, the Buddha said, "I have worked hard for many kalpas to liberate obstinate living beings. Those who have not yet understood the Dharma will surely fall into states of suffering." Kshitigarbha Bodhisattva said, "Even if their good deeds are as little as a hair, a drop of water, a grain of sand, a mote of dust, or a bit of down, I shall gradually help living beings to liberation. World honored one, do not feel distressed over beings in generations to come." He repeated this vow 3 times. Shakyamuni Buddha was delighted and said, "My blessings, I appreciate your strong vows and praise you for your efforts to heal the human world. When you fulfill this great vow after many kalpas, you will become a Buddha. So Jizo Bodhisattva became known as the Bodhisattva of Great Vow. There's a monastery in Oregon called Great Vow Monastery, named after Jizo Bodhisattva. We can't help but be struck by the similarity with the Lotus Sutra and wonder if there was a direct influence. As in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha entrusts the care of the beings on earth to a bodhisattva of this earth, which is also to say he entrusts the care of the earth and its being to us. A great responsibility, isn't it? So we need great vows to support us. Let's remember that when we chant the bodhisattva vows at the end of this talk. But first, I'd like to tell one more story. This is from Dogen's fascicle on the Lotus Sutra in the Shobo Genzo, or Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. This fascicle is called Dharma Blossoms Turn Dharma Blossoms, and it's about the Lotus Sutra. And it's a story that Dogen tells about the great 7th century Chinese Zen master Huineng. A monk named Fa Da visited Huineng's monastery and boasted that he had chanted the Lotus Sutra 3,000 times. Huineng said to him, "Even if you have chanted the sutra 10,000 times, if you don't understand the meaning of it, you won't even know your own errors." Fa Da said, "Because I am stupid, I have only been able to follow the words and chant. How can I understand the meaning of it?" Sometimes we feel that way when we chant Zen chants. I'm sure you've all had that feeling once in a while. So Huineng said, "Chant it for me. I will elucidate its meaning for you." Fa Da began. But at chapter 2, the chapter about skillful means, Huineng said, "Stop. The essential meaning of this sutra is the cause of the Buddha's emergence into the world. Many parables are expounded, but there is nothing more than this. This cause is the single essential matter. What is the single essential matter? It is the Buddha unfolding knowledge and entering realization. You are originally Buddha knowledge. You who have this knowledge are a Buddha. You should trust right now that the Buddha knowledge is your own mind." And skipping ahead a little further, he continues, "The meaning of the sutra is clear. It is you who are deluded. Those in the three vehicles cannot fathom the Buddha's wisdom because they think and analyze. However hard you think and project, you remain far away. The Buddha only expounds for ordinary people, not for Buddhas." That means the Buddha uses skillful means to teach various kinds of beings. "Those who walk away from the Buddha's sermons look for the three carts elsewhere, yet they are already seated on the white ox cart outside the gate." He's referring here, for those of you who remember, I think it was Michael's earlier talk about how at the very beginning of the assembly on Vulture Peak, 5,000 people walked out on the Buddha. And the Buddha said, "That's all right." Here, Huineng is saying, those people who walked out on the Buddha are looking for three carts elsewhere. They're looking for a better way. They're shopping around. And yet, they're already seated on the white ox cart, the single vehicle outside the gate. Whether they know it or not, whether we know it or not, we are implicitly awakening together with all beings. The sutra, going on, Huineng says, "The sutra clearly tells you, not two, not three. Why don't you understand this? The three carts are expedient means. they were taught in the past. The one vehicle is reality. It is here now. I want you to leave the expedient means of the past to the past and return to reality. When you return to reality, it is not merely a name. Know that all things are rare treasures that belong to you. Receive and make use of them. This is the meaning of the Lotus Sutra. Chant it every moment, from kalpa to kalpa, day and night, without opening a scroll of the sutra. So this is a Zen take on the Lotus Sutra. Huainong is saying, your living is the chanting of the sutra. Wake up to your life right now, and you will hear the sutra being chanted in the rushing stream in the forest and in the rush hour traffic. You will hear it in your child's laughter and weeping. You will hear it, you will speak it. You will speak it with every kind word, every kind action. Dogen wrote this poem in a series about the Lotus Sutra. Day and night, night and day, the way of Dharma as everyday life. In each act, our hearts resonate with the call of the sutra. So thank you for listening today, and let's chant the Bodhisattva vows together.